Tonight on Open Paddock Podcast, episode 207, IndyCar, Texas Turmoil, and the Fontana Finale. Silly season begins now. Monster Road to Indy, two champions are crowned and one is nearly so. Winterfest gets a reboot. Formula One, Suzuka! Mark gets miffed again. Braun issues an ultimatum to Mercedes and Marussia has delusions of grandeur. Rally, the government cannot stop. The Lake Superior Performance Rally. Loeb crashes in France as Ogier seals the title. And Rally America posts their 8-event 2014 schedule. All this and more begins now on the OpenPaddock.net podcast for Tuesday, October 15th, 2013.
Higher performance and faster and more reliable.
You are listening to the Open Paddock Podcast, bringing you the finest in rally, Formula One, IndyCars, Mazda Road to Indy, sports cars, and other news from all around the world of motorsports. Now here is your hosts, Sean, Mike, Doug, Mike, and Kevin.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to episode 207.1 of the OpenPaddock.net podcast. We just won't talk about last week. Last week was a giant...
The redux, yes. This is the redo.
Yeah, exactly. And so this week, unfortunately, Mr. Neely has plague. Mr. Whitesoul has work. Epic amounts of work. And so it's just three of us, gentlemen. I'm joined by our fearless leader, Mr. Sean Peachin. Good evening, Sean.
Hello.
And the rally guru himself, Mr. Mike Shaw. Good evening, Mike. So, gentlemen, first order of business this evening is a beverage roll call. Peachin, go.
I have water, and it will be followed by an iced mocha frappuccino from the grocery store.
Oh,
so, you know.
He's away for just a little bit, and look what happens.
What's that?
Say so you're...
Exactly. Die of the plague.
I know.
And then call me back. I'm in good health.
I'm channeling Neely here. So where's the vodka, man?
It's on hold. I've not been, obviously I've had a lot of things going on. So I have not been around as much as I used to be, and that is one of those things that I still do on occasion, but not as often as I used to. So it's kind of like Twitter, well, only I don't really Twitter anymore. So so I don't have Twitter anymore.
And the world is poorer for it.
Huh?
The world is poorer for it.
Of course, but it's made your job easy because you don't have to worry about sending me messages. Exactly. So, you know, I'm looking out for you. And
thank you,
we
thank
all
you.
Know that most podcasts where I'm severely intoxicated don't last that long. And if they do last that long, it's because I've probably fallen asleep at the desk. So it's, you know, it's probably best to kind of stay away from that stuff. But, you know, it's whatevs. There's still time for it. Please believe I was drunk as shit this Sunday, so...
Well, yeah.
I had to be
we'll
cheering
that,
for your...
We'll
I started to say I had to be cheering for your team, Doug.
Well, not just mine. I was really worried there at the beginning of the game. We were kind of sucking ass, and I was all prepared to make good on Mr. McCandless's threat to you to come beat crap out of you for bringing your bad Jets mojo to Arrowhead Stadium.
Well, I have to tell you that you may be in a bit of trouble because I was talking, and I think we're gonna try to make the Texans game as well as maybe try to go to the Browns game as well. So
that's like playing Shawnee Mission North.
Well, the Browns are reasonable this year, and the Texans, well, they're just falling apart. So
Yeah. Their
fans are cheering their quarterback getting injured, and we know what happened last year with the Chiefs when Matt Castle got injured. So
yeah, we went, yay!
Yeah, exactly. It led to a 2-14 season. But hey, you know, I was happy. I was there, and we broke the world record.
Yes, the loudest stadium in the world. Suck it, Seattle.
Yeah.
You guys finally beat the Little Northwest. Congratulations.
We reclaimed the title.
Yeah. See, it was a bogus attempt by the Seahawks fans anyways.
Don't they play in a dome?
Well, they don't play in a dome, but they have an overhang.
Oh, well, that's cheating.
Arrowhead, and I was talking actually.
Yeah, have you seen the weather up here?
I was talking.
Especially Seattle?
Well, I was talking it over with the lady friend, and that was one of the problems that we were talking about is, like, there's not a lot to really do in Seattle in terms of, like, big sporting events. We obviously have well documented that there's no IndyCar race or really any professional motor race up there, and there's not – I mean, the Mariners are horrible.
Yeah.
And so all you really have is two things, the resurgent Seahawks and the Sounders. And the way that stadium is built, I think, is more conducive to being loud in terms of gathering those decibels needed to set records like that. Whereas Arrowhead is, like, really big. And if you look at the way it is on my profile picture, it's really open.
Yes.
So
there's no overhang. It's just
a
big bowl.
Yeah, it's like a really big bowl. It's really wide. It's really open. And I think that by really showing, by really cheering loudly and setting that record, I think is just not to take anything away from Seattle because I love the Sounders, but I think it was just a little bit more.
Excuse me, what about the Portland Timbers here, bud?
Okay, anyways, who?
They beat the Sounders.
Are they the curling team?
No, they would be the soccer team.
They're the MLS team. They're not too bad.
Okay.
But see, down here in Kansas City, we also have Sporting KC.
Exactly. The champion winning Sporting KC.
I don't know when they've won a championship. I know that they were like first round. I know that they were like the first round number ones last year, and they lost like immediately to the Houston Dynamo in the first round. And I don't know why we're really talking about this anyways, because we all know that I hate American soccer. So
yeah, I don't really follow it. Just the news been talking about how good the Timbers been doing. So
exactly.
That's about all I know.
But Mr. Shaw, I will say, Seattle does not get a pass on their climate and having their little overhang. Because have you seen Lambeau Field?
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's true.
Have you seen the Ice Bowl?
Sure, yeah.
The frozen.
All right.
Cheese heads, man. Yeah.
Yeah, so... All right.
So Mr. Shaw, what are you imbibing tonight? You were mentioning pre-show that you had a fun little excursion and found something quite delectable.
Yes, the Northwest up here is well known for its orchards and for apples and pears, and so they have this thing in the Hood River Valley, which is where also the rally, the Oregon Trail Rally, goes right through that area. And this time of year, it's the big harvest, and they have this thing they call the Fruit Loop, and basically it's all the different farmer stands that go in this big, like, 25-mile loop through the whole little valley there. And you can stop and try literally like 50 different varieties of apples, and they're distinct and different. And stopped at one of the places there. It had a little brewery place that was called Foxtail, and it was Foxtail Cider. And this is their Docklands Cider that I'm enjoying tonight, and it's quite the tasty beverage.
Nice. It's apple cider, I presume?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Because I've heard of a pear cider that I'd really, really like to try.
Yes, pear cider is very good. I've had that. They also make a pear wine that there's a place called the Old White House that's right there off the highway, and it's an awesome wine. So, obviously a little bit sweeter, not too sweet though, and it's just great conversation wine. But it's a pear wine, delicious stuff.
That stuff I have actually had pear wine, and it's very good. So I'm jealous.
Well, I am enjoying a lovely premium small batch Siesta Key spiced rum,
a
Florida rum with honey and spices. It's spice. It's very, very tasty. It's made there in Sarasota, Florida. My aunt brought this back from her or from our family condo down there.
Legit.
Yeah, and you know the. my grandfolks had a condo down at Anna Maria, which is right across the bay from Tampa and St. Petersburg, and I've long wanted to go down there and stay there and go to the St. Petersburg Grand Prix, but it always comes right in the worst part of the semester. But anyway, at least I've got some rum from the place, and it is very, very tasty. Yummy, yummy, yummy. So anyway, there are your beverage choices for the week. Thank you for joining us, everyone. We'll see you next week. Oh wait, no, we got to talk about motorsports, don't we? Oh, okay. So moving on to what we're supposed to be talking about instead of what we have been talking about. Let's start with IndyCar. They had an autocross down in Houston.
Might as well have been the way the
road to the track was. It would have been safer if it had been. They just set up some cones. But
Doug, last time I checked, I thought you spent more time designing and putting together a course than they did.
Well, I will say that the course design was pretty good. I mean, when you looked at the layout and in the two races, when you looked at the racing that happened, the racing was actually pretty decent. The course really lent itself to some good overtaking opportunities, some good high speed racing, some good technical bits. It was a nice track. The problem was that it was laid down on a very sketchy parking lot. it's one of those things, a course design never survives first contact with the venue.
They needed almost an off-road suspension for how bumpy that was.
Well, yes. Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, you know, when we set up or design a course for autocross, for rallycross, we bring it out, we set it up, and then we look and say, well, this isn't going to work because, you know, this surface here is just too sketch. And so there's always some changes that are made. Unfortunately, they didn't really have a whole lot of time to do this because they had the Texans game, I say with air quotes. What was it? They had 5 days, I think, to throw the track together, get everything in place.
Yeah.
And the surface they're racing on spent most of its time underneath some artificial turf, right?
Right.
And so, you know, they pull it up and they look at it and they're like, oh my God, the Pirelli World Challenge guys go out there and they're getting a foot of clearance off the off this huge bump on the front stretch, and you know they're breaking suspension and busting floor pans and everything else, and you know the IndyCar guys are like, this will not do, and so they had to bring out a grinder and tried to grind out that huge bump. The Maserati Indy guys actually had to deal with a little tire barrier chicane that was set up there on the front stretch, you know, kind of a one car at a time through sort of deal, get everybody to slow down and mitigate that bump. But they removed that for the IndyCar race. And that helped with that huge bump, but still, I mean, wow. I mean, you know, we thought that you always think about how bumpy that St. Pete is or Toronto
Baltimore.
Or Baltimore. Well, yeah, especially Baltimore, right, with the railroad tracks.
Exactly.
But, you know, those were nothing compared to Houston. I mean, it was just insane. And, you know, fortunately, we avoided a major disaster in race one, most of race two. Race two ended very, very poorly, and we'll get to that in a second. Mm. But, you know, the issues with the surface itself, notwithstanding, what did you gentlemen think of the racing action itself? Sean?
As far as the actual racing went, I thought it was okay. I don't think it was anything that like leapt off the page and was like, oh, this is so awesome. But then again, with as much time that was spent on the course, you know, I thought that they did pretty well with the racing. I thought there was some pretty good battles. I thought the strategy was really cool and added a lot to it. But at the same, and it was just kind of, and it was really, if you think about it, the first time that I kind of sat down and watched the double races, or the repeat, I thought that the standing starts were horrendous. again.
No, you gotta give him credit for this for the second standing start.
Race two.
Second,
yeah. This. Well, yeah. The second.
It took the fourth time to get it right. Right.
Exactly. Well, yeah. The last one looked good when they finally got off and rolling. I'll agree. That was pretty nice. But yeah, I mean, I thought. I don't know what was happening. There were just cars hitting things and going into the walls after the standing starts, and I was like, what the hell? But I thought, as well as we'll get to in a bit, I thought the racing was good, but I thought that it was really cool to see the championship, the way the championship kind of went along. And, you know, the race actually had something to do with the championship, and that's important to me, and made the racing even that much better, given the number of things that were happening to the championship leader. So you could really kind of see the other car, specifically Dixon, just really kind of battle it out.
Well, you know, first of all, Mr. Shaw, your thoughts on the racing action.
Yeah, you know, like you were saying about the track design, first of all, I'd like to say that I really enjoyed how wide it was. There were a lot of good passing opportunities, except for the bumps. These guys, you know, some of them that were crashing out, I can't remember who, he took off his gloves, and you could see the blisters on his hands. I mean, it was just not fun for them to drive. By the way, in IndyCar, there's no power steering. It's not easy. Yeah, yet. That's something that's been actually talked about for safety purposes. But anyway, I thought, like Sean said, I liked the championship chase going on there and how that ended up happening. I mean, it sucked in some respects in the fact that, you know, you don't like to see anybody just have mechanical issues, but... You know, after what happened to Dixon in the past, you know, with other people doing stupid stuff to him.
Karma.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was worthy. You know, it was the right. It just happened karma-wise. Yeah, exactly. He deserved to get what he got and ended up, you know, higher up in the points. But yeah, I thought the racing was pretty good. It was just too damn bumpy. If they smoothed that track, if they did the same exact thing on a smoother surface, same design, I think it'd be epic.
You know, you do make a good point about how wide the track was, and that I think really helped out with the ability to make some good passes, choose some different lines through there. It's not something that you have opportunity to do on a lot of street circuits. You know, a lot of street circuits like Baltimore or Long Beach, you are restricted to, you know, at most a 4-lane roadway width. Right, and that's if you're lucky. And
that would be the front stretch.
Doing this in a parking lot, you know, we kind of joke and make fun of, it's IndyCar autocross. But you know, being in a parking lot, it does give you that ability to really widen out the stretch or the straights and especially the exits of the turns and allow drivers to pick, you know, multiple lines through and give them some room to race without wadding themselves up into the wall. But yeah, if we go back to Houston, it has got to be smoother. They have got to grind and repave that surface. There's no way we can go back there and have a legitimate race without that happening. I just don't think you can. But moving on, you know, and Sean, you brought up something about how you like the mix up in the championship with what was happening with Elio, the championship leader going in. You know, he ended up both days just having horrible mechanical issues, and they were directly related to the bumps. You know, the bumps separating, you know, breaking basically the seal between the engine and the gearbox, and you know, transmission fluid runs out, gearbox becomes a box of neutrals, right? And unfortunately, we'll talk about this when we get to Mazda Road to Indy. But this affected Peter Dempsey as well, who was running for Team Moore, doing great until the bumps claimed his gearbox. You know,
was it race one that Elio had the gearbox issue, and the Penske team in the pits was able to swap out the stack in 7 laps.
Oh, yeah. It was brilliant. It was brilliant stuff.
That was an engineering marvel, being able to do that. That was great.
Well, now keep in mind that it's not like changing out your transaxle in your front-wheel drive car or your tranny in your rear-wheel drive. Those are mid-engine cars with the gearbox really kind of hanging off the back, right?
Sure.
And the half shafts are coming out of the more towards the front of the gear stack. So all they have to do is remove the rear panel, slide out the gear stack, catch all the fluid, slide in a new gear stack. Seal it up, drop in the requisite amount of fluid and go. It's still very impressive. I absolutely agree. But keep in mind that the geometry of the drivetrain really allows that sort of swap to happen. But yes, the Penske guys did it in just lightning time. It was amazing time.
And they did it right there in the pit box. They didn't go back to the garage or anything like that.
No.
Not that there was a garage, but a tent.
Go back to your tent next to your hauler. But anyway, the bumps really claimed a lot of people. Well, they claimed Ryan Hunter Ray, too, didn't they?
There were a lot of cars that suffered the bumps and the issues with the transmission and everything, and I can understand, but, I mean, you kind of had to know going in that it was not going to be some smooth-as-glass kind of facility, because I know that a lot of the good drivers were having mechanical failures and issues with the car, but, when we look at the championship picture as a whole, I mean, how many times now has this – I mean, if I'm wanting to win an IndyCar championship, the last team that I want to be associated with is Penske. Because,
they do have a recent record of tossing it all away in the latter stages of the season, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is the same thing that we see every year, is the fact that these guys get into the later stages of the championship with a pretty substantial lead, and then out of nowhere, it just comes collapsing around them. And that's the same thing that happened to Helio. And now, you talk about just some of the things that they have to go through to, he's led the championship pretty much the whole entire year. And now all of a sudden, just because of one track and one set of bumps or multiple bumps on one track, now it's all gone. I'm none of the other, the Ganassi cars didn't really have that big a problem. They had problems for vastly different reasons. But,
it's not just Helio, of course. It's Helio this year. It was Will Power last year.
And the year before. And the year before.
It all started with
Briscoe, right?
It all started with Briscoe in 2009.
What was was that at Motegi that he took out the witch's hat?
Yeah, it wasn't even the witch's hat. He was leading the championship, and I think all he had to do to win the championship was finish the race. And it was six laps to go it wasn't 6 laps to go. It was towards the end. All he had to do was finish the race. He left the pits and got too heavy on the throttle and put it in the inside pit wall, as soon as he left the pits and put it in the wall and broke the suspension.
I was thinking that was at Motegi, was it not?
It was Motegi, yeah.
Okay.
It was Motegi. It was Twin Ring Motegi. They were driving on the oval. He had it. He had the title, and he juiced it coming out of the pits and hit the inside wall and broke the suspension, and it was over after that. And then, obviously, Will Power's things are well documented. It's just – and now Helio with a box of neutrals, and the likelihood of him winning the championship coming out of Fontana is next to impossible, I think.
We'll get to that. Hold that thought. Hold that thought. But really, the story of Houston, all the great racing, all the amazing passes that we saw.
Attempted standing
starts. Simona's brilliant drive.
Yes.
Getting her best finish of the year. In
Justin Wilson performing well in both races.
Yes. So all these great drives, these great performances were overshadowed by the last few laps of race number 2.
The last singular lap.
What was it? Was it on the final lap? Or I
it
thought
was.
It was the last, the penultimate.
It was the final lap.
Okay.
It was the final lap.
But anyway, so Franchitti and Sato are battling for position. They come around a corner, and Franchitti is on the outside trying to execute an outside pass on a quote-unquote street circuit. And, you know, anywhere else, you know, except maybe turn one at St. Pete. Trying an outside pass like that, I just pointed and laughed, right?
Well, also you have to talk about how Sato got a little loose.
Well, no, I'm getting to that. But being out there, just about any other street course venue is insane. But as you mentioned earlier, the width of the track enabled you know Franchitti to think, okay, you know, maybe this outside move can work. And so he's not alongside Sato. He's just behind him on the outside. They're coming around, and of course the bumps there unsettle Sato's car. His back end slides out to the left as Franchitti has an enormous head of steam, and Sato in that slide slows down, doesn't get the drive out of the corner that Franchitti does. Franchitti comes up over his left rear and just gets airborne. Again, and but this time he's right next to the catch fence. Slams into the catch fence. His car disintegrates, and it's just a hideous looking thing. Franchitti would. I'm not going to say he was okay. He's not, right. I mean,
he got injured.
Yeah, he got injured.
But not fate. You know, nothing too bad. But I mean, he got injured.
It's going to put him out for the Fontana race, you know. So
out for the season,
right? And so well, the season, one more
well,
race.
Yeah.
But yeah. And so Ganassi had to get a replacement, and we'll talk about the Franchitti's replacement here in a bit. But you know, he was conscious and alive and talking in pain, but you know, he was okay. It could have been a lot worse. You know, there's going to be a lot of people that say, well, you know, Sato's just being Sato. And, you know, no, it was one of those things. I blame it on the bumps. You know, Sato's car got loose, unsettled by those bumps. Franchitti was in a bad spot, and, you know, it just happened. The real tragedy of that event was really the fan injuries. The 13 fans and the one IndyCar official who were also injured. Thankfully, none of them seriously. I think, two fans were held in hospital for a little bit, but they were treated and released.
Yeah. Basically some stitches.
Right. But when Franchitti hit the catch fence, a section of the fence was launched into the grandstands that were there. And that's where most of the injuries came from. And, you know, my real concern about that whole thing was not necessarily catch fence. The catch fence kind of did its job, right? It kept the car and most of the big bits of debris on the track.
Yeah, I'd rather get hit by a fence than a race car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would like to see some horizontal cabling that would couple adjacent sections of catch fence together, like you see at most other permanent.
And there was one other thing that I read an interesting article on, was that this specific catch fence, this is the same kind of fencing they've used at many of the other street courses.
Yeah.
But it was missing something. Center poles.
Oh.
So they had the edge poles. All the other ones, there is a spot in those big concrete blocks for a center pole. What happened when Franchitti's car went in, he went right into that gap, right into that looser part where it just kind of buckled. Now, I agree with you on the cabling. That would definitely help as well.
And
but
I think that
there also wasn't that extra support of another pole right there in the middle.
Well, you know,
it would have helped at least. It wouldn't have bowed.
Well,
as...
it would have helped from it might have helped to keep the fence from launching into the stands, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it also would have provided more of an impact for Franchitti. I really am going to stick with my idea of the horizontal cabling. You know, mechanically coupling adjacent sections together being the better. Although, really, my concern is the placement of those stands.
Yes, I know, completely agree with you.
Where
it was located was just, and it wasn't so much even the close. It could be that close if it was, I think as you were saying, just like, all you need to move is like 30 yards up the track a little bit. Because you just look at where that apex of that corner is, and you know, the outside part of that corner, and you know where the inertia of every car is going to go.
Yep.
Don't put stands there.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, I mean, it was bad because it was, like, right there. Did you guys see the eyewitness video?
Oh, man, that was sketch, wasn't
CNN?
It?
Yeah, where it's,
that
like...
That was scary stuff.
You see Sato twitch, and the next thing you know is here comes Franchitti, like, in your living room. And then it just, like, blows up in your face, and I was like, holy snap, dude, that was unbelievable. But yeah, I think if you move the seats back another 20 yards, 15 yards even, you're going to mitigate a lot of those issues because that was just huge impact. And I don't blame any one person. That was just straight up racing, hard racing over the bumps. I think Sato got a little squirrely. You know, if people are to blame him, I think you're kind of ignorant to how race cars behave, especially on a track like that. But I mean, you know, it was just a product of the track and the product of where the stands were and trying to get people close to the action. But unfortunately, that's a really high speed corner and things like that can happen as they did.
It is the highest speed corner, and you know, when you look at that footage, you know, the one thing that you don't see right up on the fence. Our photographers.
Yeah.
They knew better.
Like, screw this, bro.
This is a sketchy place to be, man.
If you see photographers, just set up a little GoPro and run away. Don't sit there.
Right, exactly. If they're not willing to stand there, you shouldn't be willing to stand there.
Exactly. You know, I want to say one other thing, too, is that, you know, as horrific as it looked, you know, there's parts shattering everywhere and whatnot, and Doug, you and I talked about it last week, the show that did not make it. You know, all the shattering pieces and whatnot of an IndyCar, and for those that just watch NASCAR and whatnot, where they just get dents and things like that, IndyCars are designed to shatter. Every piece that gets blown away from the tub that the driver's sitting in is energy you're taking away from that accident, from the driver. And it did its job.
Yeah.
That the DW12 did its job. You know, Franchitti was contained. He was never ejected. He, you know, the car landed and he was still secured in there. Yes, his ankle got broken. And he had some vertebrae. Yeah, that were cracked or something like that.
And a concussion.
But I mean, for the violence of what happened, that's rather understandable. The cars of 15 years ago, that could have been fatal. Easily.
It certainly would have been a lot worse. Would have been a lot worse. So, kudos to the mechanics of the car. You know, the dynamics of the car and how that'll happen. You know, we take automotive safety really for granted anymore because vehicles and especially racing vehicles are so much safer than they used to be. But it is still a violent, violent sport, and sometimes that really rears its head in the cruelest and most brutal ways. As we experienced this last week, we lost a couple of racing drivers this week. And if you follow any kind of motorsports news, you've heard. And so we're just glad that Franchitti isn't among them, even though he has blocked me on Twitter. Anyway, this leads us now going into Fontana with a new championship leader coming out of Houston. Scott Dixon now leads the iSide IndyCar. Well, it's not long to be the iSide IndyCar series.
Right.
Leads the championship with 546 points to Elio Castroneves's 521. And so complete role reversal going into the Auto Club Speedway in Fontana, California. You got to think, especially after Pocono, this is advantage Ganassi.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how many times have we been saying this the last few years? Or you know, heading in there was a chance for Ganassi victory. But I think it's just like we were talking about moments ago. This is karma, as far as I'm concerned, for every for all the garbage calls against Dixon this year. Yeah. Not say that Castroneves deserves to be out of a championship, because I don't think anybody really ever deserves anything. I think you kind of make your own luck.
Well said, sir.
And I think that Castroneves has proven that he is a good driver and that he can compete at the highest level. The issue being, unfortunately, to be the champion, you know, he's kind of been just getting by and the last few races, and Dixon's been winning, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, has Helio even won a race this year?
One.
And, I mean, Dixon is unstoppable right now. So, you know, finished, first during race one, finished second during race two?
Yeah.
I mean, are you serious? I mean, the guy, we said it earlier in the year. We said it actually right before Dixon started winning, right about Toronto, is when we said, man, you know, Castroneves is okay, but we're getting into Dixon territory. And look at what he's done. He's absolutely crushed the competition ever since Toronto. I mean, he's had like one bad finish, which was Baltimore, I think.
Well,
he got run over by
he didn't
Will Power.
And let's talk about the litany of shit that happened to that race. I mean, that's not even his fault.
Yeah.
Nope.
So
he didn't have the greatest of finishes at Sonoma. He finished 15th. Uh-huh. Even though he led the most laps.
Right.
But yeah, Baltimore was a DNF. Texas was a DNF as well. You know, and those hurt. Sao Paulo, he was 18th, and he didn't have a great 500 either. And of course, that's double points, right? And so, yes, he has four wins, but there's been some not great finishes that's hindered his championship. And in fact, he's had four wins, right? He doubled up in Toronto. He won Pocono. He won race one in Houston. Outside of that, he's only had two other podium finishes.
Huh.
At Alabama, at Barber Motorsports Park, and in Houston, around Reliant Park. Helio, on the other hand, has had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 podium finishes. Oh, okay. Well, they have the same amount of podium finishes. Never mind. My point is mute.
I started to say, you got to win.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you do got to win. You know, the one thing that Castroneves has going for him is he does not have a DNF this year.
Mm.
He does not have a DNF. Even in Houston, where he had all the mechanical problems, as Mike, as you pointed out, they got him back on the racetrack.
Yep.
And got him back and going. So anyway, coming into Fontana, definitely advantage Ganassi. And I would say that, you know, when we look at the Chevy versus the Honda power plant issue, Chevy seems to have a little bit more power, a little more grunt than the Honda plant.
Did.
Well,
I don't know if that's still.
Maybe not, but the Honda plant gets better mileage.
Yes.
than the Chevy, and so especially on the ovals, that really can play large into the race strategy, as Dixon proved at Pocono, and I think this could play out once again as we get into Fontana. Fontana very often becomes a fuel mileage race, a strategy race, and so do you see any circumstance where Dixon does not come out on top of the championship at the end of the Fontana race?
I think he will win the championship, because even in a fuel mileage race, that would be to say that he does not that he like DNFs or he crashes. I don't see it from Dixon.
Almendinger is paid to take a dive and spear Dixon in the pits.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, and I wouldn't want to be Almendinger if he did, because given the love lost between Penske and Dixon, he'd probably go over and slap the shit out of somebody. But I'm not saying slap either. I mean pummel.
yeah.
I would not want to be Tim Cindric. How's that?
Yeah, exactly.
I certainly think that there's no such situation where we don't see Scott Dixon winning the championship, only if nothing else, because even if it does turn down to a fuel mileage, the gap of 25 points, or however many points it is, it's 20-something, whatever that gap, I think it's just too much.
25, you had it right.
Yeah, so 25 points between him and Castroneves with, what, a total of 50 up for grabs?
53.
Yeah, so that's a tall order. I mean, you'd have to have something catastrophic happen to Dixon for that to happen. I think it's Dixon's to lose if he crashes like we've seen Power do or something like that. But, you know, I don't know. It's going to be tough for Alio.
Well, you know, as I alluded to earlier, Allmendinger is in for the third Penske car in Fontana. You know, is this maybe leading up to a full-time ride for Allmendinger in 2014, do you think? Or is this just a continued part-time gig that maybe he continues into 2014?
I think it's only a part-time gig because if I heard right, he's got a full-time cup ride lined up for next year with the dudes who used to run. I don't know if it's true or not, but what I heard is I thought that he was going to be running full-time cup with the team that does Bobby Labonte's cup effort. It's like the what's their sponsor? It's some ridiculous like
everything clean. In NASCAR is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's
true.
Like he drives like the Lysol car or like the Brownie car or something like that. I don't even remember, but like he has like a full up Toyota.
Wait, the what car?
Brownie, I think.
I thought you said Brony.
Like,
and
paper
I'm like,
towels?
Wow.
No.
I imagine this little unicorn Pegasus, yeah. You know, My Little Pony
yeah.
thing. I'm like, ah.
I could be wrong about the sponsor. I probably am, but I know that it's a Toyota ride, and I'm pretty sure it's full time. I'm pretty sure they already signed him for 2014.
Okay. So, but anyway, yeah, Allmendinger is in for Penske, and Penske's looking for every little advantage that they can give to Elio. I would not be surprised at all if Allmendinger is given orders to be a blocker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the time comes. But as we move into Fontana, I don't know how exciting this is or not, but the 2014 IndyCar schedule is set to be revealed there in the pre-race show for the Fontana race on NBC. Is there really going to be any surprises to the 2014 schedule? Don't we kind of already know what it's going to be?
I was told anyways, that it was all pretty much same as business, but we were going to have, like, a couple swaps, but that was really, like, it, and so with that, I said, cool story, bro, next. talk to me next year when we're talking about getting actually premier racing venues on the calendar and not Houston.
Parking lot races.
Yeah, autocrosses. So, you know.
And next year, what, they're going to be holding this in June?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
The race will be in June because we have to have the championship done by Labor Day.
Well, you know, and happening in late June, and this is something that perhaps we can talk about more when we actually hear what the schedule is, but, you know, I'm worried about Iowa, whether it remains on the schedule or if it moves elsewhere. But, you know, I keep thinking of Houston as hot as it was in October, how brutal it's going to be in June. Oh my God.
Well, yeah, Texas is not a place where I'd want to be in the middle of summer for an IndyCar race.
You've been down.
You know where IndyCar used to go in June?
PIR.
Damn right. Just saying. Just saying.
But Sean, you've been down in Texas for the Texas Motorsport race there in Fort Worth, and you know during the evening it was fine, but during qualifying during the day, oh my God, it was brutal.
Yeah, it's pretty hot, and I've just been there, you know, through a number of things, just to know it's a hot place to be. I don't want to be necessarily down there in the summer. One of the issues I have, I don't really know what to say about the calendar, honestly. I you know, it's one of those things where if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it at all. I'm trying to work on that. I'm not doing a very good job, but
good karma, sir. Good karma.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say that I don't have much excitement, and that the one new event that they're getting is on the calendar is stupid, anyways. So why, you know, I don't really care. I hope they don't move too many things. I don't really care about the Grand Prix of Indianapolis. I won't be going. I won't be watching. I won't be doing anything.
I'll watch. I won't be able to go, but I'll watch. It'll be. But it's more of a. It's kind of like the Carnival Geek Show type thing. You watch out of morbid curiosity.
Right.
I don't know if I can even do that, because it's like, why do we have to have this when we could just have our 2 weeks of practice back?
Yeah. Well, you know, for those of us who remember the month of May.
Yeah.
You know, we had the entire month, and now we only have 2 weeks. So, yeah, I can see this leading, you know, lending a little bit more excitement to the whole thing. So, but anyway, it is what it is. And, you know, next week when we find out what the schedule is, maybe we can hash and talk and rant a bit about it then.
All I'm saying is I just want races at Premier Racing facilities.
Well,
I don't want Houston parking lot races. I want Laguna Seca, and I want Laguna Seca, and I want like Road America. I don't want Houston. No offense to our Houston friends, and I don't want and like the ideas of Providence. I don't want Providence or any race of that nature.
Well, yeah, it's like an old guy I used to know, an old Marine I used to know. People in hell want ice water too.
Right, right.
So
I know.
Anyway,
it sucks.
Yeah, but as we mentioned in speaking of Houston, Dario Franchitti is definitely out recuperating from his injuries there with his. Intimate meeting with the catch fence. And so in driving the number 10 car for Target Chip Ganassi Racing is Alex Tagliani. Tell me what you think about this grab. Is this a good seat? I mean, well, it's a good seat. Is this a good choice of driver in that seat?
Not if you're trying to win the championship with one of your drivers. He'll be able to take, because they still do points for pole position, right?
Right.
So you might be able to take that point away from Helio, but that's it. When it gets to actual race time, it's gonna be pretty bad, I think.
You know, so. I agree. Tagliani, he's a decent driver on the twisty tracks, but he's definitely not who I would have chosen for an oval race, especially a super speedway race.
I would choose him, if nothing else, for the fact that he can qualify. I mean, he's reasonable. If you remember his performance at Texas, and his performance in Indianapolis was reasonable last year, or
absolutely
last year or 2 years ago. But the fact is this, like, he can't get it done. Like, he starts strong. He qualified as well. That's fair. That's taking away a point. I'll give you that. But he doesn't finish the race well. I personally, I don't know who or what the schedule looked like or what his schedule was. But naturally for me, I think my choice would have been to have I would have probably taken JR, to be honest.
That's exactly who I was going to say. You know, in terms of the available drivers out there right now who are familiar with this chassis,
yeah.
JR Hildebrand is exactly the person I would have solicited. You know,
especially for a super speedway. Yeah, agreed.
Exactly. I think he's the kid that really could have got it done for you. And so, you know, not to, you know, it's not that I dislike Tagliani. It's just I think Hildebrand really was the right driver for that. And speaking of Hildebrand, who got jilted by Panther, ejected from that car. And you know, have we heard about Panther doing anything great and wonderful since then? No.
Nope.
And National Guard says, you know what, you guys at Panther, you're not really doing it for us. They are switching to Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan Racing for 2014. And quite honestly, I am not surprised. I am not surprised.
No, you can't really be surprised. I mean, with the way the money and the military is going, especially like sponsorship and all that, if you're going to sponsor a program, how about you don't suck? And I think that, you know, I think it's good to, I really think that it's great that they moved to a team like Ray Hall Lanigan. I don't know, you know, obviously Graham Ray Hall's performances have been not fantastic.
Well, they've not been atrocious either. He's done reasonable.
Well, yeah, and I think that he has a chance, or at least Bobby Ray Hall, that is, has a better chance at being successful than does Panther.
Yes, absolutely.
Panther's lost the plot.
Well, Panther is hobbled by Barnes, aren't they?
Yeah, Barnes and his seemingly, I'm so smart, I know everything, and and his pride gets in the way, and yeah, sure, it got it done when the IRL was around because you didn't have super stiff competition.
He didn't have real competition.
Yeah, but when you're racing against the best teams in the world, dude, you need to change some things. So,
well, yeah, so one of the things that I like about this move is that we get National Guard back with a young American driver. I will admit that Graham Ray Hall is not my first choice. I really thought J.R. Hildebrand was the perfect match for that sponsorship. I really did. That was a great match for that sponsorship. But I think that Graham is better than some that have occupied that seat. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm happy to see the sponsorship stay in IndyCar, even if it does switch teams. But speaking of switching allegiances, Ganassi, who has been in Canaan, who has been a stalwart with Honda in recent years, Canaan is confirmed moving to Chip Ganassi, and Chip Ganassi Racing is confirmed moving to Chevrolet Engines in 2014.
Boy, that is huge about the engines. Canaan is going to make a move, but the engines. I had to like rewind and play that part again. I'm like, does that say that right? Am I really reading this? And I'm like going on the internet to make sure it's like they got it right, right? You know?
Yeah.
He's been with Japanese Power forever.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when Toyota was still slugging it out in the IRL, you know, Ganassi was one of their primary people, one of their primary teams. When they went away, they fully invested in Honda, and they've been a great partner with Honda over the years. But now they're moving to Chevrolet. I'm a little perplexed by this, to be honest, because it seems like that, you know, they're leading the championship with Honda Power.
Yeah.
Honda has led them to do very, very well in the 500 in the past couple of years with the DW12 chassis and the new engine architecture. I'm really kind of perplexed by this move. I'm not sure really what the motivation is.
Just throwing this out there. Is there something they know about issues with the development of the new twin turbo version of the Honda engine?
You know,
next year?
That may be it. That may be it. You know, being so tapped into Honda and Honda Performance Development, you know, maybe they saw some disturbing signs in the development of the Honda's twin turbo that they're going to have to come up with for 2014. Everybody's going to have a twin turbo from here on out, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even and Honda has even mentioned it, you know, we need a third manufacturer in here. And IndyCar has been working very hard to attract a third manufacturer that isn't Lotus.
Right.
and so, you know, whoever that third manufacturer ends up being, they will have to
Fiat. Or I mean Dodge.
Even right. Worse, you know, it's like out of the frying pan into the fire. You know, if it is that company, it's going to be an Alfa Romeo badge, not a not a Fiat or a Dodge. What I would love to see is Audi.
Audi diesel.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. As brilliant as it would be, it's not going to happen. Yeah, bringing that TDI engine, oh my God, that would be epic. Have the TDI versus the Mazda Sky Active versus the Honda and Chevy petrol power plants. Now we're getting back into what really attracted me to IndyCar in the first place, right?
And throw in a Ford EcoBoost, which actually that's a likely one to come in the future, I think.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so? Ford get back involved?
No, and we'll talk about this in a future podcast because we're running short of time and we need to move along. We will come back to talk about this this engine issue. But anyway, so yeah, a lot of things happening here in the off season. Silly season is already upon us, and things are getting wacky. I think you might be onto something, Mike, about the about Ganassi maybe seeing something they didn't like in the development of Honda's new twin turbo. But of course, IndyCar was not the only racing series running there at Houston. Right. We also had, in addition to IndyCar, we had the Pirelli World Challenge. And unfortunately, Mr. Weitzel is not here with us tonight to give us a rundown on that. And he will agree with me. Best sports car series in America right now is Pirelli World Challenge. It's brilliant stuff. But the Maserati Indy was there. All three rungs of the Maserati Indy ladder were there. And let me start with the top and work my way to the first rung and begin with Indy Lights. Karam wins. Karam wins decisively. You know, we had talked about, in fact, we had Mr. Portante on a while back to talk about this very thing, about who had the real advantage going into Houston, thinking that, Gabby Chavez was really we thought maybe might have the edge in Houston and could have, or not Gabby Chavez, I beg your pardon, Andretti driver, Carlos Munoz. That he might have the edge and perhaps pulling out a couple of strong finishes here in Houston on street circuit, and maybe taking a substantial championship lead into Fontana, but Munoz really suffered some mechanical issues. He had the same problems that Elio was suffering and that other people were suffering, is that the bumps got to him. And Munoz ended up DNFing, finishing in dead last place. And that kicked Munoz all the way back to fourth place. Karam, by the way, wins pole, sets fast lap, leads the most race laps, and takes a victory. He dominate the race. So that puts Sage Karam in a commanding lead in the championship. Well, commanding, I say. Certainly puts Carlos Munoz really on the outs. Jack Hawksworth also ran afoul in Houston. Some of the hyper-aggressive, not so thoughtful driving that he exhibited back in Long Beach came to the fore again in Houston, and he was called out for it by race control. Race control finally put their foot down, and after he basically hip checked Zach Veach to the curb, ending Veach's race. Veach had to retire after their altercation. Hawksworth was brought to pit lane for a penalty for avoidable contact, for blocking, and for not following the course. So all three put him back in sixth place. Gabby Chavez hung tough all race long and badgered Karam for all 40 laps of that race. And it was a nice battle, but Karam really did really did a masterful job. And, you know, to be honest, it is not surprising. Karam's first win in Pro Mazda, then Star Mazda, was on, or his first twisty win, I should say, was at Toronto on a street course. And so, again, you know, not surprising that that he was able to pull out a win at Houston. These challenging, variable terrain type of street courses, lots of bumps, you're always searching for grip. It's really the type of racing where Karam really excels. You know, Shaw, you'll appreciate this. I would really, really love to see Karam give the Snowdrift Rally a chance.
That would be pretty epic.
It wouldn't it though? I think he's got the skills to really do well at that type of racing. I that type of ability.
That takes so much patience because there's no studs.
No. And, you know, you're always searching for where do I have grip? Where do I not have grip? Where is my car balanced? Where is it going to be? Where it's going to be, you know, thrown out of balance. Those are the things that on these street courses where the racing surface is very changeable. You know, and it's not smooth. It's not predictable from corner to corner. This is where he really excels. So I would love to see someone give him a little Subaru RS or something like that to go run in open lights or in the in super production or give him a Fiesta R2 and let him run in the two wheel drive class. It would be epic, man. I think it would be brilliant.
Those little two-wheel drives, let me tell you, I mean, I like how they a lot of the drivers talk about it. It's like you're dancing on your tippy toes.
Yes, yes,
you're constantly,
exactly.
You know, you just got to keep that inertia all the time.
Yep.
And it's, yeah, that's
always,
the best thing you can say is dancing on your tippy toes.
You're always playing with the throttle and the brake simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say that even my jump skills as a racer when I'm autocrossing with my little Focus, it's constant little, you know, feathering the throttle, little dab of left foot braking every now and then, just to find out where I've got grip, where I need a little more, you know, trying to maintain the attitude of the car, you know, all that. And, you know, it's one of those things, as I said, that Karam really excels at. And so, you know, he did a masterful job at Houston and has a good lead over Gabby Chavez going into Fontana. And going into an oval race, I think this is absolutely advantage Karam for the championship.
You think so?
Oh,
even after Munoz and his, man, he's awesome on an oval.
He is not as good as Karam on an oval. Carlos Munoz, I think, is really one of the best talents in Indy Lights, and I really, really hope he gets a ride in a decent ride in IndyCar next year. But with two DNFs, one in Baltimore and then again in Houston, unfortunately, his chances are shot. But if he were where Chavez was right now, I would still say advantage Karam. Munoz, I think, is the better natural terrain road course racer, but Karam is the better oval racer.
Fair enough.
Not that Munoz is a bad oval racer. He's a very good oval racer. Well, he won Pocono, right? Won
yeah,
Pocono
exactly.
Very handily. But you know, I think right now this is Karam's championship to lose. Brabham dominated Houston. I mean, it was the Matty Brabb show. Again, there are only three races out of the entire season that Matthew Brabham did not win, and there was only one that he did not finish on the podium. He had a DNF at Mosport due to contact that was not his fault, and that was it. Otherwise, it was just it was a season of sheer dominance And so Matthew Brabham gets a scholarship to move up into Indy Lights next year. Do not be surprised to see him in the 7 or the 77 Sam Schmidt car. That seems to be where the Mazda graduates end up. And so that's kind
of exciting to see him in that, you know, in that next tier up. That's going to be make the series that much more exciting to watch. And
well, especially
I hope they
with
keep
the...
with the television coverage next year too.
Well, keep in mind there's a lot of changes that are coming to Indy Lights, and in over the off season we'll
right.
talk about those more. But there's some chassis upgrades. They're not changing the chassis, but they're introducing some dynamic changes to what the chassis will be. Of course, we're bringing in Cooper Tires as the tire manufacturer instead of Firestone for next season. So it's all good. It's all good. And it will be interesting to see just how Brabham does. In the two USF 2000 races, boy, it was a mix. The first one was kind of predictable. Your typical players, except for Heinrich Ferusuth, last year's national class championship. He scored his first podium position in race one at Houston, scoring a P2. An amazing race by Heinrich, finishing just behind Neil Albarico, who took the top spot. Scott Hargrove, who set the pole and set fast lap, and I beg your pardon. Ferusuth set fast lap. Hargrove led the most race laps. Hargrove finishes third, and with that had clinched the USF 2000 title for 2013. And it's a good thing too, because he DNF'd in race number two, which was in a torrential downpour, absolute torrential downpour. And in a recent addition to USF 2000, Alexander Barron, who we talked about at the Laguna Seca race, he won his very first race in USF 2000 at Laguna Seca, the very first time.
That's just setting you up for a failure there, isn't it?
Well, you know, in Norway,
oh, my.
You know, you dominate your very first race, everything else is a letdown, right?
Yep.
Unless you win again.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what he did in the rain. There in race number two in Houston. Neil Albarico finished in P3. Heinrich Ferusuth scored a second P2 finish, so a fantastic weekend for Heinrich. I really hope that someone gives him a chance to step up into Pro Mazda next season. I think his performance this year, and especially late this year, demonstrates that he definitely belongs. He's ready to move up. He has the skills. So that's it for the Houston races there in the Mazda Red Indy. The only other addition I have for Modern Winterfest gets a reboot. Before the USF 2000 and only the USF 2000 series, went to Sebring for three races, and then went to Palm Beach International Raceway for three races. But this year they're moving to a relatively brand new state of the art facility in New Orleans, or just north of New Orleans. And they'll do three races there, and then they're going to do three races at Barber Motorsports Park. So some proper racetracks. You can say that Sebring is a proper racetrack, but man, it's bumpy as hell.
There's that one specific bump.
Yeah.
That's Sebring, right?
Yeah. And, so
and it's on the high-speed corner.
And this will be, I think, a better set of venues for these young drivers. Like before, there will be two triple headers, three in New Orleans and three at Barber. But in addition to the USF 2000 this year, they're going to be joined by Pro Mazda, who's going to do two double headers. So they'll have four races, two in New Orleans and two at Barber, and then 4 days of testing for Indy Lights. So all three rungs of the Mazda Road to Indy Ladder will be participating in Winterfest. And it makes sense, since now all three rungs of the Mazda Road to Indy Ladder are under Dan Anderson's jurisdiction, right?
Yeah, having Dan Anderson, that's the key. That's what's going to make that ladder series successful. We all know it. Yeah. He's got a plan. It's going to grow under him. It just will.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm really excited. I was so stoked when I heard that he was taking over the operation of Indy Lights. It's so cool. I'm so excited about that. Well, moving on from American open wheel racing to European open wheel racing, or in this case, Asian open wheel racing, Formula One. Formula One was at one of the most magnificent circuits on the Formula One calendar. In my opinion, second only to Spa, and that is Suzuka. What a magnificent circuit this is. Did you get to see the race, sir?
I did actually get to see the race. It's such a great circuit, like you said. You know, it's got all the bits, you know, sweeping S's that are high speed, and you really have to have your car configured right. You know, good long straights, you know, where top speed is important, and a couple of tight twisties in there. You got the bridge, you know, where you go in the over and the under. I mean, what isn't to like about Suzuka?
You know, my favorite corner on Suzuka. You know, I love the S's for their technicality. You know, that's really where, that truly is where you make or break your lap times, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've got to say that my favorite corner at Suzuka is 130R. You know, you come out of Spoon, you go down that back stretch, and then you just gotta have the nads to keep your right foot planted and turn. Oh man, what a magnificent corner that is! It is an absolutely magnificent corner. And so yeah, I love Suzuka. Brilliant circuit. And this year it was also a brilliant race. We saw some great action at Suzuka.
Some great action and some some interesting strategies playing out. Surprisingly, Vettel wasn't on the pole. It was actually his teammate, Webber. So it was great to see Webber actually perform pretty well, especially since it's, you know, his swan song. He won't ever be back to Suzuka again. So. Romain Grosjean, wow, what a run he's doing. He's obviously really bonding to that Lotus Renault chassis real well.
Yeah, you know, Grosjean really did have an outstanding race. It's a race that he really needed to have. Given how strong and how dominant Kimi had been over Grosjean, pretty much all season long. He really needed this for his own confidence, I think, if nothing else. But, you know, it was a little, you know, you spoke of strategy. I thought the strategy there at the end played by Red Bull was a little odd.
Obviously, it wasn't in Webber's favor.
no.
You know, the announcers, were saying that, you know, Matchett and Hobbs and stuff were going, wow, it seems a little early for Webber to come in for his first tire change.
Yeah.
And he was actually earlier than Grosjean and earlier than Ferrari. And so why is he coming in already? I mean, they'd already deemed that he was going to do a three-stop race. But, I mean, if he wasn't hurting that bad position-wise, you know, he was keeping up with Grosjean. Grosjean was a little ways ahead, but, you know, he was in a solid second spot. And if he wasn't really, if his tires weren't falling off, which in this case, they had the hard tire and they had a medium tire. They didn't have a soft tire. So the difference in lap time between the hard tire and the medium tire, you know, in their best, you know, first lap, you know, run was literally, I think they said it was like 0.3 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hardly anything. So milk those tires for all they're worth, right? Unless you got a tire going down, which he didn't.
You said he was in second, but his position relative to Grosjean did not matter. His position relative to Vettel mattered. And I think that's what elicited the odd strategy change and why Webber is a little miffed. Although, really, you know, Should he be surprised? I don't think so.
Not
you know,
it's been.
Yeah, you know, if you're surprised by this now by Red Bull, you know, you're as dense as a you're as dense as a rock. You know, you had to know that if that Red Bull was going to do everything they could to ensure that Vettel got maximum points,
or at least the opportunity to get them. Yeah, sure. And if Alonso finished eighth or worse and Vettel won, he won the championship
right there. Right, right. And you know,
so they could have been planning from the beginning.
And not that
for sure.
the driver's championship equates to money for the teams directly from the FIA, but it still equates to money for the teams, right?
Yeah.
In prestige and in ability to attract additional sponsorship money, even the current sponsorship that you have, you'd say, hey, you know, we've won it four times in a row. We think we're worth a little bit more than when you signed on. You know, there's some leverage.
And the kid's 26.
there's some leverage that you can play. And so, you know, I don't think there's any question that Red Bull's coming away with the Constructors' Championship. And, you know, the way they played the strategy to put Vettel ahead of Webber just adds some additional insurance without having to pull a Ferrari at Hockenheim when Barrichello was ordered to let Schumacher by.
I think so. Yeah. That was Hockenheim.
But
yeah.
Anyway, you know, at any rate, you know, they didn't have to resort to something like that, but they still engineered the finish that they wanted. They got their 1-2 finish with Vettel on the top step. That is the perfect finish for Red Bull.
And in all honesty, it wasn't easy for Vettel.
No, it wasn't.
He had to really stretch those tires. And when, you know, the other guys had pitted and came out, and both Grosjean and of course Webber and the Ferraris, I mean, they were doing their 2.6 second pit stops. I mean, they were quick. Yeah. These guys were all quick.
Well, and did you see the blister that had developed on Vettel's front left?
Yes, I did. But that was because when his tires were going off at the very end, he was just a couple laps before he pitted, he was going a little hot into the corners, because that was when he was trying to get as much of a, you know, the tires were starting to fall off, and he was trying to build up enough gap as he could.
Yeah.
Because he had no traffic in front of him. Everyone else was, you know, had done their pits earlier, and he just wanted to stretch everything out. And so he was going a little hot and ended up cooking the tires into the corners a little too much, getting some flat spots. So I think that's what played out to the blistering later. But yeah, when he needed to, though, they did have to calm him down a little bit in the earlier part of the race. Say, look, you know, we're going to try a different strategy. Calm down.
Well, he was stressed all throughout the race. I mean, when you heard him on the radio, he was about three octaves higher than what he normally was.
That's very true. But, you know, after that, and then, of course, you know, after the second pit stop, he also had to, or that first pit stop to do the two, or second pit stop for the two-stop strategy, he had to just really kind of back off, save the tires. But he really wanted to be up there. And, yeah, he was definitely, especially with traffic, because when you're doing a different strategy from everybody else, you're going to sometimes end up in a pack that you don't want to be with.
Yeah.
And that made it definitely a little more challenging. But when it all played out in the end, he ended up, three or four seconds ahead?
Yep. Yeah, he stretched out a good gap.
So that was, and that's after the final pits, that he ended up 3 or 4 seconds ahead. So that's impressive. That's a good 8 seconds that he was able to make up on everybody else. So that was a pretty impressive run there. So you got a hand to the guy. He could definitely conserve when he needs to and push when he needs to. Yeah, but yeah, same two. Red Bull 1-2, and then Grosjean getting there in the third. It was really good to see. It was actually that final after the final pit stop of Webber and him catching up to Grosjean. It was interesting, because if there was another 6-7 laps of that race, he would have caught Vettel.
Well, catching him and overtaking him are
you're
different.
You're right. They're different. But the amount of time he was catching up to Vettel per lap was pretty considerable, as his tires are so much fresher and he was able to push.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, so it was a good race. Other excitement that happened in there was the two Ferraris. Massa ended up out in front of Alonso.
And yeah, he was not real... he was rather reluctant to give up that spot.
Yeah, exactly. And even yet, Matchett was saying, it's like, you know, seeing as he's not going to be on the team next year, you don't think that he's going to probably give that up too easy. And he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And
so they gave team orders over the radio and to move over and to let Alonso by, and he said no. And
no.
Kept trying to hold on to it.
Yeah, no. There's no passing, no. And, you know, Ferrari said that they weren't going to what was the phrase that they used? Basically they weren't going to penalize him.
What are you going to do? He's out next year. I mean, yeah. Really.
You know, and so, yeah, I don't know. He's sitting there trying to make himself look as racy as he can for any future employers. So, yeah, I don't blame him at all. But speaking of strife amongst teams, one that...
It's new. It's F1.
Well, yes, there's always drama, right? But one that kind of surprised me is that Braun has issued an ultimatum threatening to quit Mercedes. Had you heard about this?
I have not.
You know, he's worried about the fact that his job as team boss has not been guaranteed.
Now, wasn't he the one that was chastised for doing the extra test?
Well, okay, you know, there's a lot of other issues around that.
But wasn't he the one that was kind of, they pointed the finger at for allowing Mercedes to get involved in that Pirelli test that they shouldn't have done?
Well, okay, now, with regards to that, both Pirelli and Mercedes went to the FIA and said, is this legit? And the FIA said, yes, go with it.
With an older car. Wasn't supposed to be a 2013 car.
They said, right? No. They said, here's our testing plan. And the FIA gave the sign-off on that plan. And so I am not going to throw up.
I just remember that Braun's name was the one that came up.
Well, of course
with
it
that
is,
whole incident,
you know,
quite a bit.
Braun has always been good at finding those little niche areas in the rules to exploit that not everyone else pays attention to. So, but anyway, so it's a little bit of a power struggle at Mercedes. You know, given how Mercedes has perform this year, you know, or do you want to be the person who seemed to be in charge? I don't know. You know, they qualify well, but man, they have just not raced well. And they had a disastrous race at Suzuka with Hamilton not even making out of turn one.
Turn one. Well, he did make it out of turn one, but the problem was is that
not unscathed.
You know, he had a great start, but where he was, Vettel got into his rear tire at just the wrong spot and into his right rear, and it immediately deflated the tire.
Well, and it was more than that. I guess once the tire deflated and started to disintegrate, it just shredded the back end of his car.
Yep.
But
yeah, he ended up losing aero at that point because after it blew, it started taking care of some of the other bits. And you know, again, like you said, with the S's and all that stuff at Suzuka, the aerodynamics are so important for those high-speed sweepers like that. And if you don't have it, there's no point. You end up becoming a danger.
Yeah, and they ended up retiring. And, you know, Rosberg did reasonably well throughout the race, but he would fade as well. In fact, he faded significantly, falling all the way back to 8th. After being significantly higher in the rankings mid-race. But anyway, so as it turns out, Vettel and Webber take the first two spots, followed by Grosjean on the third step of the podium, Alonso back and forth. That makes it very challenging in these last, what do we have? We got four more races. We've got Indian Grand Prix coming up here in a couple weeks, and then Abu Dhabi, another of my favorites. I love the Abu Dhabi circuit.
Yeah.
And then the U.S. Grand Prix at Circuit of the Americas in Austin, and then the traditional season-ending Grand Prix at Sao Paulo in Brazil, Interlagos, there at the end of November. So four races, and Vettel has a pretty dominant lead in the driver standings. He's got a 90-point lead over Alonso.
Yeah, Alonso already said that the championship was won after what did he say? It was in July.
Yeah,
pretty much.
So unless Vettel just gets whatever plague that Neely has,
it's stupid, right?
and is out for the season. That's it. Vettel has the championship. And Renault has an obscene lead in the Constructors' Championship over Ferrari. Mercedes had been duking it out with Ferrari pretty close in the Constructors, but they fell back. They're now 10 points adrift of Ferrari and the Constructors, and that's real money. I mean, that is real money.
And with that last four races left, that's painful.
Yeah, and so I don't think you're looking at who finishes first in these last few races. I think you're looking at who finishes in second, third, and fourth. I think that's where the really interesting stories will be.
It's all about the dollars.
Yep. And so now we move on to, your favorite area, sir. And we move on to the soft stuff, into rally. Although,
I wouldn't say soft stuff. Actually,
I was going to correct myself that this past rally at France was all tarmac, wasn't it?
That's correct. Rally de France. We tried to talk about it last week, but unfortunately, that podcast fell through.
Podcast shall not be named.
Right. And not this last weekend, but the weekend before was the WRC in France. It's actually outside of Sebastian Loeb's hometown. It was his swan song final rally in the WRC ever in his career, so he says, and I wouldn't doubt it. And it was really great. He actually had a special livery on his car, and it was great. The car had on all these numbers, and it showed 896, which was the number of stage wins that he's had in his career. It had his 78 for the number of rallies that he had won. And it had, obviously his 9 for the championships he had won. And, all these different, little numbers all over. It was this black with the gold writing on it. And it was really neat to see that. He is a legend and always will be for motorsports and especially for rally. As much as I wanted to hate the guy just because he always frickin' won, he just an amazing sight to see of what he could do with a car, both what he had always said, that he didn't always race at 100%. He actually raced at 90%.
Yeah.
But he knew when he needed to turn it up to 100%. But he'd always say in that safety barrier, he didn't like going 100%. That's why he didn't like Finland. Finland, you had to go 100% all the time.
Yeah.
He hated Finland. Which is what makes him a little bit different from Ogier. Ogier likes pushing the 100%. Which is what makes him actually a little bit more exciting as a driver. But Loeb's 90% is equal to everybody else's 100%. So, and especially when you're talking about on a sealed surface.
Yeah.
But not so fast. In France, there's a couple of things that factor in the rally in France. First of all, we now have the young kid, the rising star of Thierry Neuville. He's the Belgian kid who is super fast on tarmac. They most of the rallies in Belgium that he learned on are tarmac.
Yeah.
And the kid's quick on gravel too. But he came out leading the rally after the on the second day, the first full day, which was Friday. And he had a little bit of a lead, but what was interesting to see is that there's weather in France. You have rain that will come in. It's just destined to happen. What I was amazed about with this event was this was the first time that I can remember in recent history on a tarmac rally where the tire choice makes such a big difference that Ford or Qatar M Sport, Malcolm Wilson's team, got the tire decision right and Citroën got it wrong.
Usually in tarmac rally, your decision is I'll take the tarmac tires.
Well, they do have a soft and a hard compound. Now, they can't cut the tires like they used to. Yeah. They used to be able to do manual cuts in them and things like that. So now they just paid, Michelin offers two tires. They have a hard compound and a soft compound. And so you get to take your pick. You know, what do you want in the boot? What do you want, on the car and go racing? And Neuville was smart. He started out with the softs in the beginning run of that first long day. And it was a little moist out there. It did not dry out as much as everybody had thought. But then later in the day, some had suspected rain would come through. Instead, it actually dried out even more. And he switched to the hard compound. He had it right, and he got a good 12-second lead from the get-go at first. But that narrowed down to where at the end of Friday, which was really cool, the top four were separated by 12 seconds.
Oh, wow.
12 seconds for the top four, and in fifth place was Ogier at the end of Friday. He was 30 seconds back.
What happened?
Who would have thought that?
It's just a poor tire choice?
Poor tire choice, and you don't have the confidence.
Okay.
If you don't be, when your car's kind of moving around, you know, you're not going to be pushing that much because you don't want to slide out of control.
Right.
So then we get into Saturday, and Thierry Neuville, you know, starts out doing really well, but then in the afternoon when the rains start coming down, and everybody knew the rain was coming, and so they all switched to the soft tires. So the tire choice wasn't a big deal on Saturday. Everybody had the same decisions.
Okay.
But Thierry goes just a little wide on one corner, hits a curb with his left rear tire, gets a puncture, and that was only 3K into a 30K stage.
That's brutal, because then you've got to limp all those kilometers all the way back to service.
Exactly. So to the end of the stage anyway, where you can at least change the spare that you got in the boot.
Right.
But so unfortunately, he lost over a minute, drops down to fourth place, fifth place, and that left Loeb, who ended up winning three stages in a row, and then ended up with a fourth stage win later in the day, giving him the 900th stage win.
Nice.
So that's
typical Loeb stuff.
Right, exactly.
Come, kick
but
ass, take names.
Latvala at the end of the day ends up in the lead with Jari Matti was doing really good. He was being conservative, which is actually smart for him.
I was going to say, who's this Latvala character that you...
Right, I know. We haven't heard his name up at the top in a while, have we?
No.
And, you know, that's the thing. He had really focused hard on tarmac to try and improve his tarmac skills, because we already knew he was fast on gravel when he didn't wreck.
Yeah, but when he doubled down a mountain.
But he seemed like the only one when Ogier last year, you know, was doing his Super 2000 stuff, just waiting for the VW car to come out. So Latvala was the only one that could challenge Loeb. He was the only one that was up there. He could, you know, be up there with Sordo, and Loeb. And so Latvala really improved on his tarmac skills. And plus you throw in a little bit of the wet stuff. He's from Finland where things are slick all
right.
the time. That also plays into his skills as well, right? So he definitely knows the slipperier surfaces pretty well. So, yeah, he ended up actually in the lead that next day with, was it Danny Sordo, Loeb, in third, and Ogier in fourth. And the top four were separated by just 5 seconds at the end of Saturday.
All right.
So you're going into Sunday, the last day, with four drivers separated by 5 seconds. Six stages left to go. Then, unfortunately, I think it was the second stage in on Sunday. Loeb goes a little wide and goes off course, rolls the car.
Wait,
DNF.
Wait, Loeb?
Sebastian Loeb rolls out of Rally de France, his home rally.
On tarmac. Man, that's unheard of.
It was pouring rain. There was standing water. It was pretty wet conditions. And so finding the grip was very difficult. All the drivers said it. You had to just take it careful. And he just overcooked it. I mean, it wasn't even a sharp corner or anything. It was just a long sweeper to the right. And you can see he's just kind of going along, and he turns in, and the car just starts sliding out. And he's like, there it goes. I mean, there's just hold on.
Well, you know, it's so unlike Loeb to overdrive a car.
But it's not. But it's so unlike Loeb to be in third.
Well, okay. Yeah. yes. I'll give you that.
You know, things dried up as the day went on, and that's when Ogier turned up the juice and started pressuring. By the end of the service stop, it was Ogier in second place, just behind Danny Sordo. And Sordo, this is one of those things where on tarmac, you're the lead driver, right? The fastest driver starts first.
Right.
Versus on gravel, usually you start in the back, right? Where you want to have there's no road cleaning going on tarmac.
Right.
So you end up with Sordo having to basically predict how much the other guys behind him are going to push. And, you know, where do you put that safety margin, right? It's, you know, yeah, you can get maybe some split results of the guys behind you, but that's after you've already completed that other split yourself.
Right.
So it's an advantage actually to the guy behind you, other than the fact that, you know, with corner cuts and whatnot, you end up with a muddier surface. But they did a very intelligent thing at Rally de France. They've tried different things over the years to prevent the corner cutting. And they devised a wonderful little device to prevent it. I mean, they used to do things like put logs on the side of the road, so it really hurt. Yeah. I think it was last year, they put these poles in the ground that they painted red. But the thing is, people would corner cut them, and those things sliced into the car.
Yeah.
They're like almost like a rebar pole, right? And it was just like, these things were dangerous. The poles ended up being dangerous. So they came up with these... It pegged into the ground were these flags that stuck up. They're a solid piece of like a hardened plastic or something like that. I think they had some flex to them, so that way if you hit them, they'd kind of pop back up. But they do some hurt. You could probably get a puncture if you hit them. So when they went into these apex of the corners, those flag things were sitting right there, and they couldn't cut the corners this time. So that meant the cars farther back actually had a slight advantage in the fact that you'd end up with they'd get the split times of the guy in front, and so they can know when to push a little harder and whatnot. So actually it gave a little bit of advantage to the guy farther back, which you normally don't get. Anyways, Ogier ends up winning the event after he had already won the championship, which was actually interesting. He won the driver's championship on the first stage of the event because they actually made the first stage, the power stage, and he just needed 1 point. So that was good because if Loeb ended up somehow winning the event and Ogier still got the championship but didn't win, it kind of would have, I don't know, I think it would kind of rained on his parade a little bit. But being as it was, Ogier ended up winning the championship on the very first round, so they got to have a big party on the very first day, which was a Friday night, or the Thursday night.
That was something he was really kind of worried about.
It wasn't really something he was worried about, but, you know, I mean, he's obviously a fellow Frenchman and whatnot, but most of the celebration, especially being the hometown of Loeb, was surrounded around Loeb's legacy and his final goodbye to the WRC. And there was a lot of Loeb doesn't like to show emotion, but when they had this final send-off for him in Haguenau, it was pretty emotional. And they had his family come up and say goodbye and whatnot. And the whole city is there, you know, in town square. And you can't help but have a little bit of tear for all the support that your fans and neighbors have given you over the years, right? Yeah. So that was pretty cool. So anyway, yep, Ogier dominant as usual. Sordo ended up in second, which is really good for Sordo. Means that he's probably still got a seat for next year. Mikko Hirvonen, not so good. I don't know what it is about Mikko, but I don't know where he's going to go next year. So, yes, so Ogier wins, sort of second. Latvala ends up in third. Thierry Neuville ends up in fourth. Evgeny Novikov, pretty good performance, staying in fifth. He's pretty good usually on tarmac. Yeah, so Mikko ends up in sixth. Andreas Mikkelsen in seventh. He's still, you know, learning all these different courses. So look for him to push more next year. Mads Osberg in eighth. He just couldn't get the feel of the car again. He's just not a tarmac guy. Robert Kubica in the WRC2. He's in ninth. Love France. France is just a great, great event. And always fun. That's one I'd like to go see. It would be probably France and see Finland.
Yeah.
If I went to rallies.
Yeah, I think mine would definitely be Finland.
Finland for sure. Yeah. So So stepping off from that, there was an interesting thing that the FIA was announcing, something we talked about earlier in the year, is that the FIA was looking into a final stage decider plan. This would be a concept that where all the you'd end up with a first and second, third and fourth, you know, fifth and sixth battle on the final stage. So think about how we have the power stage now where it's like an extra points thing. But instead of that, you'd still have your traditional rally all the way up into that final stage. And basically, time wouldn't matter anymore on that final stage other than between the two drivers going for position. It kind of takes away from the traditional rally sense. I know they want to make something exciting for television. There's actually a talk about television being on 7 different events possibly next year, which would be great. So the idea is you'd have you'd have first and second would challenge each other for position, but regardless if some guy gets a puncture and ends up losing a minute on the stage, that he'd still end up second at worst.
That's not rally.
Which I have an issue with that.
I do too. That's not a rally.
They're investigating it and how it would work out. Everybody's talking that they want to have some sort of change that makes it more exciting for television. So I don't know what the right solution is. Rally isn't what it used to be already today anyways.
No, it isn't.
Rally is a series of sprints now. It's not the longer like the Safari was, which is a classic.
Yeah, that was an epic rally. I love that. That was one of my favorite rounds.
You know, those long distance things, that's called the Dakar.
that isn't in Dakar anymore.
Right. It's the Dakar of South America.
Right. Race it into truck and onto bikes and...
right.
Okay, bad humor.
So, you know, it's interesting. I don't know what to say about it. Up until that point, it is a traditional rally. That's kind of this one of the shootout kind of concepts. We'll see if anything happens with it. I'm not going to badmouth it till I see it and see how it plays out. But yeah, it's kind of sad to see.
It smells like jumping the shark to me.
I liked the power stage concept. I thought that was pretty good right there, where it was a sprint on that final stage to see who could get a little extra points. But that doesn't seem to work when the same person always wins the power stage, I guess. So they kind of thought, that's probably going to happen in the other format too, but whatever. speaking of Robert Kubica, he's been doing so well in his WRC2 that he's already been named by Citroën to get a ride in the full spec WRC car for Rally GB.
Nice.
So he was not planning
to a works ride in 2014.
That is 99% certain. Sadly, that means that Chris Meek won't be seen in GB.
Well.
But he kind of sealed his fate down in Australia.
Yeah.
We'll see if something happens again next year and he gets another opportunity. We know he's fast and he's got, especially on gravel, he's a great driver on that surface. But Kubica, what's interesting is, this is his first year ever racing on gravel, and he had some issues at first, some punctures and stuff like that, learning what gravel was like and what the car could handle in the WRC2 class, and then the next gravel event he wins, you know? So he's got no – and then you throw him on tarmac, where, of course, Formula F1 driver, he just dominates.
Right, right.
The only one that can keep up close to him is Elfyn Evans, the Welshman who's in a Fiesta R5. And he was within a minute because he got a puncture, but otherwise can keep within a couple seconds of Kubica. So that'll be interesting how that plays out next year, especially with both of those guys. I'd like to see what happens to Evans next year as well. But yeah, good on him. Good to see Kubica out there. Then we get back to our home front. Rally America.
Oh, they're still racing.
So, yes, they're still racing. Rally America has, of course, they've had a little bit of a break here, but the final round is the Lake Superior Performance Rally, and it almost wasn't.
I was going to say, that's a lot like the 100 Acre Wood Rally. It's held in National Forest, isn't it?
Yeah, some of it is. Some of it's on private land. Some of it's done in the national forests. And that's where they ran into government shutdown issues. And I have ran into this locally here in Oregon myself. I was going to volunteer and help out for the Mount Hood rally, which is one of the, you know, the last ones of the year that we have over here. But again, Forest Lands, the whole event was canceled. National Forest Lands. And same thing here. I mean, they had already paid their permits. All they needed was the keys to the gates, pretty much, right?
Right.
And unfortunately, the office is closed. Sorry. Bye-bye.
No refunds.
Right. Probably not. So at Lake Superior, what they did is they had to quick change it up. One of the stages, they're actually repeating 6 times.
Holy crap. Are you serious?
Now, that's going to get, you know, that's going to get pretty beat up for...
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, in addition to being repetitive, you know, it's going to, it's just going to be brutal for that surface.
Now, I don't know if they're going to, like, reverse direction partway through or something like that.
I mean, even if you do, it's still going to tear up the road surface.
It is going to tear it up. And what'll be really interesting is this is a notable season for rain.
Yeah.
So imagine the sloppy mess that you would have.
Well,
of six running through a stage.
What's the forecast?
You know what? I have not looked at it for this week. You want to give me a moment?
Okay. You know, because I'm thinking, you know, just a straight rain isn't, you know, that's not a thing. But if you get rain, or if you get a wet, heavy snow leading into this, and then turning into rain, you really run the risk of having the, you know, some conditions where you've got 3-4 inches of nothing but mud, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about, is the mud part, and
you know, a little bit of slick stuff on top. They're rally drivers, they can deal with it. But, you know, if you get the ground saturated with a wet snowfall early and then compound that, you know, with rainfall afterwards so that you have, you know, 4 inches of super soft mud, man, it's going to be a disaster.
Looks like Friday and Saturday we have a few showers on Friday, then Saturday rain/snow showers.
Boy, what was I just talking about?
So that will be interesting. I did hear, though, that because I was following on Twitter and stuff, people were wondering what the heck. They are going to, I think, try and grade it between the 2 days.
Okay.
So that might help. We'll see.
Good night.
couldn't hurry. So thankfully this event that is really the final event, and there's some championships to be had here. That's why it's like such a big deal. This must go on. It is win it or bin it time.
Yeah, can you imagine this being canceled?
Oh man, there would be an uproar. Yeah. There would be an uproar. So David Higgins with Subaru Rally Team USA leads Ken Block 95 points to 91 points if you drop out the lowest scoring one for the season so far, because they, of the 7 rounds, they only score 6 rounds.
Okay.
So if you take their current points and you drop out the lowest one, it's 95 to 91. And
wait,
with that
what
spread,
would it be if they actually canceled it?
It would have been 92 to 97, I think.
In favor of?
Higgins.
Okay, so Higgins takes the lead either way, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So Block needs to win to take home the championship. It's a win it or bin it.
Yeah. Well, and knowing Block, it's a flip a coin.
You know what? But he has been really good this year. When he was down, his only real big issues he had was the one that you saw.
Yeah, I was going to say he didn't look. Didn't look like things have changed much at 100 Acre, but.
No, but when he was up here in at Oregon Trail, when he was over at the STPR, the New England Rally, he's really done well at, you know, doing more of a measured pace now, and then where he needs to, he's been putting the hammer down a little bit. We know he's got the superior hardware to the Subaru, not by a large margin, but in some of the twisties, he can just accelerate that little bit faster.
Well, he's got the shorter wheelbase as well.
Shorter wheelbase and lighter.
Yeah.
It's just a lighter chassis.
It is.
So, and he's got the, see, he's not, it's not quite a WRC spec car. It is WRC spec up to the point that he's got the 2-liter engine with a turbo. He doesn't have the 1.6.
Yeah.
So he's got a little more torque in there and can accelerate even faster in a WRC car. So there's something to be had there. Plus, they have it where the restrictor allows them more power than what WRC does. So it definitely comes down to it right there. If you follow, there's a great series that Subaru's been doing to follow the championship, their whole season. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it called Launch Control.
No, I haven't.
Look for it on YouTube, Subaru Launch Control. It's a great series. Goes kind of behind the scenes and stuff. It's all done by Subaru, but it's very high quality production value of the whole season. And they're going to have a two-part finale for coming up to this, and including what happens afterwards. So it should be good to watch. And so that's not the only championship, though, that's up for grabs here. The next level down would be Super Production. It's pretty much in the bag for David Starrett. He doesn't need to win. Well, he needs to do anything but have a DNF.
Okay, if he DNFs
and Mason Moyle wins, Moyle can take the championship. But that's what it would take. The young kid, Mason Moyle, he's been so good. I remember seeing him when he was just a young kid out there and rolling his car at Oregon Trail and whatnot. This last year was his first time really finishing, and he ended up on the podium. And he's had multiple podiums this year, actually. Even though he hasn't won an event, he's been on the podium almost every event for Super Production. And so just that consistency. He's got a new co-driver, a very experienced guy that's with him. And that's really been a huge help, having that older, more experienced person to kind of help calm him down and help him through the pace notes and keep his pace where it should be. It's a possibility, but it's a long shot. Starrett has been so fast, really so much faster than anybody else in Super Production. He's been as fast as the open class cars in a Super Production car. So then it comes down to two-wheel drive. We've had the Australians, Brendan Reeves and Rannon Smyth. They didn't even start the season until I've got to do a correction. It's now Rhiannon Gelsomino. She just got married 2 weeks ago to Ken Block's co-driver, Alex Gelsomino.
Oh, nifty.
They've been dating for a while now, and they met at the WRC events, mm-hmm. and got along quite fabulously, and that's kind of bridged over here to the U.S. So it is now Rhiannon Gelsomino. So congratulations to them. Brendan Reeves and Rhiannon are sitting. They started at Oregon Trail, and they've won every single event, four in a row, since then.
Oh, wow.
So they missed the first two rounds. They don't have a drop because they're missing two rounds. Mm. But they've won every single four in a row. And ACP, though, is still leading the points since he's been at every event. If you drop the lowest one so far, he's sitting at 89 points, and Reeves is sitting at 88 points. 1 point apart if you drop the lowest one right now. Again, win it or Bennett. So Reeves has to take that Fiesta R2, and they gotta get the score at the top to win this one if ACP if ACP is going to get second. And he's got a turbocharge. Even though it's that ugly bread box of a Scion, it's got a turbo in it, and it pulls pretty well. Final couple items. I was going to make a little plug for, if you haven't seen it yet, there's a rally documentary that's been talked about for the last 2 years called Easier Said Than Done. It's one of the filmmakers that had worked with Rally America and rallied himself. It's finally done,
that
and it's available
Matt
online.
Johnson, right?
Matt Johnston with a T.
Johnson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Matt Johnson is the guy that you normally see behind the mic for some of the coverage for Rally
America.
Oh, okay.
Lincoln. So I was getting the two confused.
Yeah. So Matt Johnston is a guy a couple years back. He does some of the beautiful footage. Go to the website of Easier Said Than Done, film.com. And you can see some of the clips, or go onto YouTube and you'll see the trailer for it. He does some beautiful imagery.
You had forwarded to us the trailer earlier, and I looked at that and I just thought the cinematography was absolutely epic and breathtaking.
Well, and you're a cameraman. You know about the RED cameras that are really good, right? I don't know a whole lot about the camera tech
stuff. I'm not a video guy.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, this guy did some great footage work. He's done everything from using drones to get, like, these panning shots as the cars go by through a corner to he had a tether where he had a zip line, basically, where the camera ran down a cable and followed behind as Chris Duplessis goes through some trees. He's had a balloon where the camera was on top of it looking at the apex of a corner. He's done all kinds of nifty stuff. And then beautiful helicopter shots. He got some great helicopter pilots to work with him. It was a Kickstarter thing to get this going, and people just poured in money because there's so many great rally fans out there. And I contributed myself, and I got a download of. You can get a 1080p download of it. You can get a DVD, however you want it. And it is just such a gorgeous film, and it goes through following Chris Duplessis, Ken Block, some more local kind of people, goes across over to the rally in Sweden and talks to Petter Solberg. Here's a nifty trivia fact. Did you know that Petter Solberg started his entire rally career in the WRC by taking out a loan for $100,000?
Holy crap.
Talk about a risk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he went into the bank and asked for that after he won the Norwegian championship. And, I mean, he's just a young kid at this point. I mean, I think he was like 21 or something like that, 20. And he's like, look, I need to get a car that I can race at this top class. And they're almost laughing at him at the bank. But he apparently had a way to influence him enough that he was able to get the loan. And he gambled that he was going to be successful. How about that?
Wow.
And there's stories like that. It talks about how even these guys that you think are so successful and have all this money, Ken Block, he's obviously doing quite well, but it's not easy.
No.
And even at the level they're at now, it's still hard. Rally is such a hard, hard sport. Funding wise, it's extremely expensive. Just stamina wise, that so much can break. I mean, this is not like just going on a nice, clean, pretty oval and going around in circles. There's a lot of stuff that can happen, and there's a lot of people that you need help from. And Duplessis, the story about him is what's so great. You know, he tried so hard. He's so fast here in America, and he tries to get his foothold by going to the WRC Academy. It was his only chance. He got actually an invite from Malcolm Wilson himself. He was 26 years old. That was the age cutoff. And he said, you know, I'd like you to come over, but he had to come up with his own money. And a lot of people helped fund it from friends and family, people in the rally community, so he could at least do some events over there. Unfortunately, he doesn't. It's such a different environment in Europe.
Yeah.
Just knowing how the rallies are run, so there's that confusion, and then just. They grew up on it, and they're just so fast. Some of the guys knew the routes already, and so, you know, when you have that those pace notes already pretty well hardened, it's going to be a little bit easier for some of the other guys. So, yeah, it is like the title says, it's easier said than done, and it's just a great story. Even if you're not even a huge racing fan, just to kind of hear these stories, how these guys persevere and continue on and keep doing. It's their dream. So many people go into rally and they pump everything they've got, every dollar they have saved for about 2 or 3 years, and then it's gone. And they just kind of start over, and you might not ever hear from them again, but they got to do their dream of doing this thing for at least a short time. And there's some great stories in there. So highly, highly, highly recommend seeing that. So then onto the finale for the evening. I know it's a long one. But they did release the 2014 Rally America National Championship schedule. So we do have the new schedule for next year.
Uh-huh.
Have the same 7 usual suspects, but there's an 8th round that's a TBA in there, to be announced.
So it's to be announced that it's going to be New Jersey Motorsports Park.
Well, but you can't really rally at New Jersey Motorsports Park. You could do a rally cross.
This is true.
But it is called the Rally America National Invitational,
tells me it's not going to be a traditional open stage rally.
Yeah, it very well might not be. I have no idea what to expect from this. There hasn't been a lot of word about it yet. Because maybe that's why it's in the TBA status. But just to quickly go through the schedule, we got Snowdrift to open us up for the year in January, which is always so much fun to watch, the studless rally.
Yeah.
The Rally in the 100-acre Wood is again in February from the 21st through the 22nd.
And let's hope it's not Snowdrift Part 2.
Yeah, that was pretty nasty this year. Of course, my favorite and the longest event of the season, the Oregon Trail Rally, May 2nd through the 4th, which I'll definitely be there. STPR, June 6th and 7th. Then they've got that invitational set up for June 28th. So they have a date in there, but I'm guessing that's just kind of in that time frame is what they're thinking of. Mm-hmm. So normally that would be the big summer break. New England Forest Rally, still again mid-July, 18th to 19th then. The Ojibwe Forest Rally, August 22nd and 23rd. So I guess your break would be between New England Forest Rally and Ojibwe if that invitational ends up taking place. And then finishing off after a long break then, again, just like now, is going to be that Lake Superior Performance Rally, once again finishing it off in October from the 17th to the 18th. So good to see returning events there. Sad to not see the Olympus Rally on the schedule again, but after what happened, and they pretty much pissed off Washington State. So it's going to run again probably as – it will run as Olympus, but it'll be a regional event. So that's it, folks. Hope we didn't wear you out too much.
All right. Well, next week we will we'll do a recap of the Rally America championship season, and of course we've got Fontana coming up, wrapping up the IndyCar season, and then in a couple weeks we've got some Formula One action. So our season isn't over yet. Although we are wrapping up a few more championships, I would say to that you should check out the openpaddock.net website. Michael Epps of Ballardi Auto Racing gave us a very fantastic from the cockpit recap of Houston, so you can relive the Houston weekend through Michael Epps there on our website, and check that out.
Listers and all.
Yes, yes, exactly. And yeah, we'll be back next week with more, and so we'll see you then.